Welcome back to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, back here with you. And we're going to be talking about some of the recent events that have been going on. They've been a disaster-laden week so far, and got my co-host and cohort in crime here, Sam Bradley, joining me from California. How's it going, Sam?
Pretty good. It's warming up really good out here, Jamie. We went from really cold last week to about 88 degrees today, and it's supposed to go up to 94 before the week's out. So that's kind of a mind bend for some of us. We're not used to that yet. But, you know, I'm looking forward to this. But, boy, this is going to be tough doing this after the last one we did with Dan Hanfling, because that was great. That was an excellent episode.
It really was, looking at our international deployments and how units from the U.S. are set up to deploy internationally and what that looks like. And if you haven't caught that episode, folks, you really need to go back and check out last week's episode. Just a great discussion on how international deployments work and how to get associated with an organization that makes international deployments, and just all sorts of good information there. So stay tuned here for more like that in the future, and check out past episodes that you may have missed. Certainly we've already got quite a few really great episodes in the can. So and that brings us around to tonight's guest, kind of a regular here on the show in many ways, and Dr. Joe Holly from the Paragon Medical Education Group and Tennessee Task Force One, is it?
That's correct. Hi, guys. Good to talk to you again.
My favorite USAR doc. Hi there.
Hi, Sam.
So tonight we're going to be really focusing on the recent storms that swept across the United States from the Midwest to Arkansas and parts that around there into Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, Tennessee, right across the southern parts of the United States. And I saw something on the news showing the breadth of this storm, and it's, of course, reached up into the middle Atlantic area as well. We've got some high winds and heavy rain hitting our area right now as well. And, you know, they said that this storm was affecting 70 to 75 million people here in the United States as a course of this storm, with multiple tornadoes and hail and all kinds of bad weather. And Joe, this is not unusual, really, for this time of year.
No, unfortunately, in the plains and the southeast, this is a pretty hectic time of year for us weather-wise. Lots of tornadoes, lots of aggressive thunderstorms, and you know, that carries us right into hurricane season. So
yep.
we're starting off with a bang, clearly.
And so it begins.
So quite a few communities were hit by some rather large tornadoes, although they seem to be some smaller communities surrounding some more metropolitan areas. But still, many deaths. Last time I saw a count on the news, they said somewhere in the neighborhood of 35 or more, maybe slightly more, individuals passed away as a result of this storm. And many others injured, and still some people unaccounted for. And that's where folks like you come in, Joe. And when people are missing in this situation, and you got to try to find them amidst the wreckage and manage their injuries. And you guys were actually thinking you might get deployed.
Yeah, we've essentially sort of been on alert. It's a little bit of notice, just with the concept that we knew storms were coming. The it's hard to say, I guess one tornado that touched down at two different locations in central Arkansas there, hit those two small communities there, resulting in, 15 or 20 deaths in each place. We're obviously pretty substantial impacts to those areas. And, the system sort of was on alert. FEMA headquarters had several teams in place and ready to go, including us, of course. Interestingly enough, though, for this deployment into Arkansas, where we have currently one incident support team and one task force, it's actually the task force out of Texas. Those guys were geographically maybe a little bit farther away than Tennessee was. I think the difference is, you know, 50 miles or something, a very small difference. But I thought it was pretty interesting in that as opposed to sending Tennessee, the allegedly closest team, they chose instead to send Texas there and hold Tennessee in Memphis, knowing that the storms were moving toward us and that were likely to cause much more damage as they move through Mississippi, which they've proven to do, and Alabama as well, with the idea that Tennessee was likely to be needed, easterly as opposed to westerly, and we had other resources in place to take care of that. So that worked out well. I've had some communication with my colleagues on the defense and support team there, and they've been busy, but not overwhelmingly busy. A lot of search, a lot of damaged structures to get through, and obviously a lot of folks missing to still locate. So they've been busy, but not overwhelmed. And we have been sort of just waiting for processes to move forward to see if we're going to be needed anywhere else in the Southeast at this point.
I think that is a good question, though, Joe. What really kicks in the need for a USAR? At what point, and Jamie talked about all of the people that were affected, but when you're talking about it affected, it's different than if your windshield blows out from hail or your chimney, your roof blows off. But, you know, what are the conditions generally would have to prevail in order for a USAR to be called out?
Well, I think there's a couple of different ways to look at that, Sam. You know, the first thing that happens, obviously, is a bit of a needs assessment that's done by local officials to get a sense of the scope of damage and obviously with a knowledge of what their local and or regional resources might be. You know, a team like my team could be deployed as a state asset to an adjoining state where the level of request from the local jurisdiction went to the county and from the county to the state, and the state felt like it could probably handle it. So, you know, we might be used through an EMAC, Emergency Medical Assistance Compact, with one of our adjoining sister states and be sent as a state resource to Mississippi, for example, to assist. From a federal level, you know, if we're functioning as a federal asset, then we are obviously deployed only on order from FEMA after approval from the president to put us in action. You know, that request would flow from the state to the feds saying, you know, state resources are overwhelmed and we need federal assistance. And that would activate, you know, we would activate in that methodology instead. So there's a couple of different ways for that to work. I think it's a bit of a balance between the amount of damage and what resources are going to be needed and what resources are available not only locally but regionally. In the event of something like these tornadoes, although both these communities in Arkansas were hit terribly hard. They were still fairly isolated events with the close regional area surrounding them still pretty intact and with enough resources to be able to flow into that void, if you will, and take care of business there. So those things resulted in some additional resources from the feds in those cases, but in Mississippi so far, it appears that the damage is not quite so widespread and that the regional resources are able to handle it, at least to date.
Of course, and I guess we should redefine. We have Jamie trained now, so he's used to all these terms, but maybe not everybody is. But the USAR is the Urban Search and Rescue, which is what you do. And then I work for the DMAT, which is the Federal Disaster Medical Assistance Team. And, of course, for us, it's much different. So your need is to be getting in there quickly, trying to get to people and hope they're still alive when you get them. So there needs to be a significant amount of damage to structures and so forth. Where we come in is when there's really, it's not even so much an immediate need because we're not an immediate resource. We are a resource that will come in probably 72 hours later to give support to the medical community and certainly to the people there. So it's usually a situation where there's a lot of people involved that won't have the normal resources available to them, healthcare resources specifically. Then also there's probably a lot of damage to the local infrastructure, the healthcare infrastructure, with Katrina being the overwhelmingly perfect example of that, when just about every hospital in Louisiana and even surrounding states were affected to the extent that people actually had to be moved into other states for medical care. But one thing a DMAT does is, and I know it's similar for you, and maybe you can go into that a little bit as far as when you leave, what equipment do you leave with, how is it accessed, how is it packed, and some of those kinds of things, and how do you prepare personally for this, even though we've talked a little bit about that. But the DMATs are set up to go into an area with no infrastructure whatsoever, no electricity, no running water, nothing. And we can set up basically, although they're tents, it's a mobile field hospital with everything you would find in most hospitals except the ultra fancy stuff, enough pharmacy to take care of people locally, certainly enough logistical support for the people working in the environment. And, you know, then we're good for several more days until we start needing, you know, more assets to come in. And usually they do, but at that point. So we don't really come in until much later. And it's usually because we talked about the fact that all disasters start as local disasters. So when you mentioned that the state becomes overwhelmed, you know, it starts locally, it goes regionally, state resources get involved to the extent that they exist. And then at that point, they reach out, like you said, there needs to be a presidential declaration for us to be deployed as a federal resource into a disaster area. So how do you set up for USAR? So Joe, what is your, you know, you need to get out quickly. So how is everything staged for you to do that?
Well, basically what we do is, you know, we have our vehicles stay mostly loaded, a standard, I guess, vehicle deployment for a heavy task force, meaning heavy, meaning we can take care of, you know, heavily reinforced concrete structures that have collapsed and that sort of stuff. So there's a lot of cutting and bracing and shoring equipment and all that sort of stuff. But that generally consists of about three tractor trailers, three box trucks, a couple of buses to haul personnel around in, and then multiple small, you know, pickup trucks and that sort of stuff that serve as, you know, work vehicles and that sort of thing. So the majority of those vehicles, especially the large trucks, stay loaded with everything except the perishables. So, you know, when we're called out, we basically have to pick up our drug cache from our pharmacy and you know, get the batteries and the perishable stuff as far as, you know, a few food items and that sort of stuff. We use a lot of MREs, obviously, but we always try to get a few fresh things to take along with us. And so, you know, our goal is that we are on the road within 4 hours of activation. There's a couple of different kinds of activation. You know, you can have these no-notice events where, you know, an earthquake happens without warning and you know, we just have to load up and go. Or something like Katrina, as you talked about earlier, where there's forewarning that the storm is coming. We're not exactly sure where it's going to be. But it's clearly, you know, going to require some resources. So Katrina, again, a great example for us as well. We were actually in New Orleans in place a day and a half before Katrina made landfall, as were many other task forces. So, you know, there were a lot of federal assets already in place and were going to work literally as soon as the storm passed over. We were up and going. So, you know, that sort of two different types of deployments there as far as the way that works. Most of the time, if we're within 1,000 or even 1,500 miles, the task force will travel there by ground, which sounds a little bit counterintuitive. You would think if you're going 1,000 miles away that you're a lot better off flying. We are palletized with our equipment to be able to put that onto a transport aircraft of some sort, military usually, and move all our equipment that way. The only downside to that is that you become, one, a bit limited where you can put that aircraft down. So you have to land at a pretty big airport someplace. And then you have to have vehicles to move all the stuff when you get there. And obviously our search and rescue function requires a lot of mobility, and we need our vehicles. So getting all our equipment there is great, but if it just sits on the on the tarmac at a large international airport 3 hours away from the scene, it doesn't really do anybody any good. So we tend to travel by ground a lot just because we can get right where we need to be, and we can have those vehicles with us, you know, so that we can literally go to work as soon as we arrive on scene.
Oh, that's interesting, because ours is quite the opposite, because usually we seem to be going farther. We could, the way the DMATs are structured, basically it's the team that's on call. So we could be on call here in California and be sent back east. But, you know, again, because we're not as an immediate resource as you are, the need to get there quickly isn't as great. And the caches are set up where we're not necessarily bringing a cache with us like we used to. There may be a cache already there locally. So basically, we as personnel go to the event, and everything will be there when we get there, and we just set it up. In your case, Joe, what is the basic configuration of the team itself? How many people are there? And what you were just talking about raised another question. Are there any situations where they would just need personnel rather immediately? We need the experts out here. We have some equipment you can use, but we need to get, say, a task force of folks there as quickly as possible.
Yeah, two great questions. The team itself is made up of about 250 people in general. The go team for a heavy task force is about 85 people. And then there's, four or five folks that are, you know, might be truck drivers or some sort of support logistics or something like that. So in essence, we are three people deep in every position. So we have about 90 positions, and we have 250 people to cover those positions. So there's a rotational schedule every month with a red, white, and blue team. And there are, one of those teams would be the first out the door on call team. And if, for example, if I'm on the go team for this month and I'm not able to make it, then there are two guys that can back me up from the other teams that allow us to be sure we can field the team in fairly short notice. Obviously, the challenges of trying to put 90 people out the door 4 hours, 24 hours a day is a pretty significant challenge, especially when you have bit of a mix of, fire and professional response personnel, but also kind of some civilian side stuff, which would be like myself, the physicians, the engineers, sometimes dog teams, et cetera. So that's a real challenge to be able to get a physician who's able to take off for potentially 2 weeks on 4 hours notice. So it's a lot about the commitment of folks who are involved in that team. We have models that are similar to what you guys do. It's kind of a hybrid model for the USAR system. In general, for a significant response, quote unquote, a level one kind of response, that would be six teams that are going to go. The first three teams would be the three closest teams geographically to whatever the event is. The next three teams would be based off a rotational model of sort of who's on call this month, et cetera, like you guys do. And while the teams tend to carry all of their equipment with them at all times, we also have some additional caches of equipment and supplies and additional stuff we might need that are scattered in locations across the country that oftentimes are put in route at the same time we are to meet us at the site of the disaster, so that we have those additional supplies and additional communications capabilities, additional geospatial capabilities with mapping and all that sort of stuff that often converge at the site of the disaster.
Yeah, and you said something that resonated with me in terms of the fact that for physicians especially, who may work in their own groups and so forth, it's really hard for them to just pull up stakes and go for 2 weeks. So even though you're covered on the USAR side, you know, what about the work side? You may only have a small number of partners that you can rely on. So there is a lot of commitment. With us, they always have our employers fully informed on what we do and that when the team's on call and this is what will happen if we do get deployed. And we're covered under something we haven't talked about, and that's called USERRA, which is something that's used in the military that gives us certain rights to where our employer can't say, no, you're not going to go, or I'm going to take your job away from you if you do. And that was a huge issue in the beginning with DMATs because we didn't have that. And especially people worked in emergency room, they just weren't letting them go. Well, we need you here. I'm sorry. So now we have that protection. But we let our employers know ahead of time what this is all about, what USERRA means. We send them documentation, and we certainly let them know when our teams are on call. So there is a big commitment to planning ahead on and not planning a whole bunch of events for that particular month, even though it may be December and you're working around the holidays or whatever, as you know, in the way we, you know, that something's going to happen. Murphy's Law, as we call it. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think you're exactly right, Sam. Obviously, that's a huge issue and probably one that, as we recruit additional positions to the team, I probably spend as much time talking with them about their support system, both at home and especially at work, as I do requirements and time commitment and all that sort of stuff. It is a huge commitment on the part of those folks in civilian world, particularly, and especially those who work, who do shift work. I'm not as familiar with engineering work, and that's in, you know, the dog guys as I am, you know, obviously the medical component, but certainly if I'm scheduled to work three days from now, then if I take off and those three shifts aren't covered, and one of my colleagues has got to step up and take care of that and has got to do that literally on 4 hours' notice of me saying, I got to go, and I'm supposed to work Thursday, and, you know, can you get this? So it truly is a tremendous team effort from colleagues and partners at work to ensure that, one guy can leave on short notice and get out the door, and the rest of his colleagues and partners are willing to pick up the slack. If they don't do that, then the team can't go. And so it's not only the physician who's decided he wants to participate, but he's got to have tremendous support from his coworkers to allow him to do that, because without that, it doesn't work. I mean, you can't leave in 2 days and go, oh, guys, I got to get back. I got to shift. Well, we're in the middle of nowhere, so you're not going to get back. It's a very challenging issue to be able to find folks who can make that level of commitment and have the support of their, of work at home to allow them to fulfill that commitment.
Yeah, and even at that, I mean, the team has to pre-plan a lot, too. They can't just put a call out and hope that a right number of people call in, because, you know, the government requires a minimum number of people, and in our case, it's usually 50 people, which is a large bunch. So like you, we often, as far as our different specialties, we're all 3D as well, with the idea being that if one can't go, the other can't go. So, but what we do is we set up a roster ahead of time. They have to have an active roster at all times during an on-call month. So we do this through our website, where we let them know what part of the month we're available or not, or if we're available for the whole month or whatever it might be. But we plan, not just, we have to figure as it even goes into the next month, because if we're looking at a 3-week deployment, you know, if there's one day in there that doesn't work, it pretty much shoots the whole thing down. So they have to create this roster around that, so people are more or less pre-positioned, although if something happens, then the call comes in, oh, I can't go now because this just happened. They have to take that into consideration too. So it's a monster of a process. People don't realize on the admin side, on the back end side for the command staff, all the work they have to do just to be ready to potentially go out the door.
Well, you are exactly right, Sam. It's a monster logistics operation just to be prepared and meet your deployment windows, especially when you may go for months with nothing happening. And it's certainly hard to keep complacency from creeping in there, and folks kind of, I'm planning this vacation. Things come up. Obviously, life goes on, and we can't spend all our time standing around waiting to do something. But at the same time, it's certainly challenging to ensure that you do have the resources in place to be able to put the team on the road. For FEMA, we have minimum requirements of numbers of, you know, people, especially critical personnel like, search team and dog team and physician and engineer. I mean, if those guys aren't available, then the whole team doesn't go.
Well, and you're bringing up a really good point about there isn't that many deployments. I think on the average, a really big DMAT deployment happens about every 5 years. It doesn't happen all the time. So with the commitment, you know, because we've been talking all along about commitment and the commitment that people are making to the team, which includes a lot of online training and includes a lot of, we do our training quarterly where we invest an entire day in doing training for our team. And you're talking about a situation, how do you keep those people engaged and interested? At what point are they going to go, you know, I'm tired of just doing this. I'm tired of waiting around. I never get deployed, you know. Not that we wish a disaster on anybody, but, we want to be there if there is one. But people get tired of waiting around, or maybe they didn't get chosen for the last deployment for some reason. So I think a lot of this focuses around training, and especially for you guys. I mean, we do a lot of training on the medical side, but you train in so many different things that you do, from the physical act of getting people out of the rubble to treating them to, you know, we'll get back to the concept of crusher injury that we were talking about. And just that right there, you have to know a lot about it. When you get this person, what are you going to do with them? So how do you guys manage your training such, and how do you keep people inspired about wanting to continue to do this?
Well, there's no question it's a challenge. I think the biggest step is often the first step. And by that, I mean, from a FEMA USAR standpoint, bringing a new physician online is a pretty laborious and long process because in essence, there's a whole lot of training hoops you got to jump through before you're even FEMA would even allow you to go on a deployment, which is why you signed up in the first place. So, once you sort of get to deployable status, it's easier to keep folks engaged, and the training is a bit more, continuing education stuff as opposed to I got to go to school for a year. That kind of thing. So, that first step is really, really challenging to bring new physicians in, or new anybody in, obviously, just because there's so much that has to be done up front to make somebody safe in that environment, have them understand what we're doing and how we do it. Just as you mentioned, the USAR environment is a pretty austere environment, and we have pretty broad coverages. I mean, I literally signed up for a canine course on how to better learn to take care of search dogs medically. So I get to be a part-time veterinarian, and just a whole lot of public health guy and environmental health guy and occupational health guy and emergency medicine and surgery, and it's this huge mix of a whole lot of different skill sets that all get pulled together in pretty unusual places at pretty unusual times.
But think about how that's broadened you as a physician. I mean, you're adding all these other skill sets and levels of understanding that most ER docs would not know. So I think it's to your benefit. What does Paragon do in terms of, do you do anything in terms of the USAR type training? We've talked about some of the things you do, but what do you have there?
Well, we do. I mean, quite honestly, Paragon grew out of our Jim Logan and I's desire to teach people about the USAR experience, as it were. Not so much how to be a USAR guy, but there's so many things to be learned there because it does cross so many disciplines, and it contains so many different elements, and the aspects of the stuff we see there are so unique that it's literally its own branch of medicine almost. And so a lot of the training that we do on, mass casualty stuff and disaster medicine, has grown directly out of our experiences in the field over the last 20 or 25 or 100 years or however long we've been doing this.
So you would say if someone was, and I agree with you, kind of what you've been talking around is the austere environment is very different, and not everybody is able to cope with that kind of austerity or to want to do medicine without a warm, well-lighted, controlled environment. So I think that kind of training where you can kind of get a taste of what that would be like, you might find some people that go, you know, I don't think this is really for me. So say if someone was interested in USAR, wanted to find out about it, would there be like an intro level training there at Paragon that they could invest in to say, okay, this will help me decide whether this is something I really want to put all this effort and this commitment into?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the majority of our courses have some element of that in them, some more than others, obviously, but that's a great place to do it. I mean, you know, it's under a controlled training environment. It's a great place to come and find out, is this really the kind of thing I want to do? And, you know, if nothing else, it gives them a sense of what that world is all about, and takes them out of their comfort zone a little bit and puts them in some situations that they are unlikely to face very often in their career. So that if they do ever get stuck in one of those situations, they're much better prepared to handle it.
Yeah, but wouldn't you say people feel good about having that level of training and know that they can do something that not everybody can do, and that they feel more personally prepared if something happened?
Oh, I think there's no doubt about that. You know, we see that all the time where folks are a little bit, I won't say reluctant is the right word, but a little skeptical and a little bit, I'm not so sure what I'm doing here, that literally at the end of the day come out, you know, with a big smile and go, wow, that was a really cool experience. I loved it. And I can do it. It's a huge confidence builder, obviously, and, you know, a great way for folks to get much more comfortable with it. The skills that they have, they just haven't exercised very much because they work in a, you know, an ED and, you know, under good conditions and with lots of support and ancillary equipment and all that sort of stuff. So I think it's almost a back to basics kind of deal in some ways that you're going to be using a lot of your basic skills, and you sort of forget, I really can do this pretty well without the need of a CT scanner, you know. That I think makes people feel very good about their own abilities.
And that's what you guys are so good at doing at Paragon, I got to say, Joe, is really giving people that opportunity to try on that new experience before they actually need to have that experience under their belt. And that's so important.
Yeah, I'm thinking immerse him in some of that.
Yeah, it really is for us a chance to come do something that they're, you know, not likely to do very often in their career. If we can sort of get them past that first time disaster experience, as it were, so that the jitters are off and they kind of know what to expect, and they have a comfort level that they can function in that environment, and they sort of know a little bit about what to expect. Then, you know, when the real disaster does actually hit, Those things are just distractors, and they pass through that very quickly, and they can get right down to business and get going on stuff. So it's a great place to get that exposure and sort of get it out of the way, if you will, so that your comfort level is where it needs to be, so that you can focus and actually take care of patients and, you know, whatever else it is you need to do to get the job done.
Absolutely, and it couldn't be better taught by two guys who actually do it. You're not talking about it. You've had that experience.
Yeah, and Joe, where can folks find out more about Paragon? Because I know just listening to this episode, there's probably going to be a lot of good questions, and people may want to look at bringing you guys in to do some specific training in a region, or look up and find out when your next training session is that they can go to.
Sure. Well, we're on the web at paragonmedicalgroup.com, or actually at prehospitaleducation.com as well. They both take you to the same place. You can find us on Facebook, Paragon Medical Group on Facebook, and our Twitter feed is ParagonMedEDU.
Great. Sam, where can folks find out more about what you're up to?
Well, I'm all over the place on social media. If you look for Sam Bradley, you will probably find me in some form. Sam Bradley on Facebook, Sam Bradley 11 on Twitter, and certainly on the disasterpodcast.com website.
And of course, you can find me under the handle PodMedic under most social media sites. And of course, all of the programs, including the Disaster Podcast and my other programs like the Medic Cast and the Nursing Show, all over at the ProMed Network at promednetwork.com. It's been a great show, guys, and I've not had to jump in and ask any questions. I've been really enjoying just listening to the two of you go back and forth, and I'm soaking up all of this knowledge. I'm the newbie here to the disaster response game, and I'm learning slowly more and more about what you guys do, and it's fascinating.
Well, good. Sometimes I feel like I get so wrapped up in the conversation, I forget you're there, Jamie, but as long as you're enjoying yourself.
Well, that's what it's all about. I mean, I'm certainly happy to help produce this podcast, but one of the reasons I'm so passionate about bringing this show out to folks is that I know I don't know much about this topic, and I know I'm not alone in that lack of knowledge. And so I want to make sure that we record these conversations so that folks can learn a little bit more about what's going on in responses in and around their communities and how to better be able to prepare themselves for those types of responses.
And we'd love for them to come up on the website because there's just such a wealth of information here. We're just talking about two of the types of teams that are out there and what we do. But we would love to hear people come up with their comments on subjects that they're interested in at any level or anything about disaster whatsoever.
Yeah, you can go to disasterpodcast.com, and on any of the episodes there, any of the articles there on that site, you just go down to the bottom of the article, and there's a place right there to leave a comment. And when you leave that comment, it automatically emails us, and we will get back to you. We respond back to everything that comes in email-wise. We'll also leave a response comment, of course, back on the same article page. And we'd love to get a discussion going. What topics do you want to hear more about in future episodes? And if there's something that we can pick Joe Holly's brain about to learn some more about some of the clinical aspects of disaster medicine, that's certainly important, too.
And there's a wealth of information.
Joe, thanks for coming on the show.
Well, I enjoyed it as always, guys. It was a great episode. I look forward to the next one.
Me too.
Sam, you want to close us out?
Well, I think what we've been talking about here clearly illustrates my tagline, which is disaster medicine is not your everyday medicine.